From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Reaction to the decision of officials at the University of Oklahoma to expel two fraternity members has been a catalyst for public conversation about First Amendment protections for racist speech. And Coastal Carolina University is 2 years into a novel campus program that pays faculty and staff for improved student retention numbers. Hi, I'm Casey Green, and I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all, and ahead of our conversation, please note you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. In our opening segment, we're going to talk about whether or not the First Amendment protects racist speech. At college campuses across the country, anger and outrage followed the public posting of a video showing fraternity members of the SAE chapter at the University of Oklahoma singing a racist song on a party bus. In response to the video, the University of Oklahoma President David Boren stated that, quote, there would be zero tolerance for this kind of racist behavior at the university. The university also expelled two students involved in the party bus video. Yet First Amendment scholars and advocates note that while racist speech is ugly and abhorrent, the First Amendment also protects racist speech, and that the university may have overreached in its quick response to the video by closing the SAE chapter and expelling some of the students involved. Many might agree that colleges and universities have an institutional responsibility and perhaps even a moral authority to discipline students for racist and other forms of abhorrent and offensive speech. But given First Amendment protections, the question that emerges in the wake of the recent Oklahoma video and other recent campus events is if campus officials have the legal authority to do so. Joining us for this conversation are Tracy Matrano, a principal at Matrano & Associates, and Robert Shibley, the executive director of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. With us as well is Doug Letterman, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. So Tracy Matrano, let me begin our conversation with you. As they say in the courts, the facts of the case seem to be pretty clear. There is a video that shows SAE members singing a racist song on a party bus. Is this really a case of free speech, no matter how ugly and abhorrent? What are the legal precedents and the boundaries that apply here?
Well, I'm not going to claim that I know all of the facts. I do know some of the facts that I've gathered from the media. But I will say that I don't think that there's a moral authority that I would base any of the decisions that were made on, but there is precedent for institutional authority. The line of cases for people familiar with this is the Tinker and its progeny, and Hazelwood, of course, would be the one that really began to dig in and find that institutions had authority to align their mission and to maintain a certain kind of order that is more circumscribed of First Amendment than we would find in the general public sphere.
Robert Shibley, at FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights, based on Tracy's comments, it sounds like education gets special consideration in the conversation of free speech. Is that correct?
Well, to the extent that education gets special consideration, if anything, the court has recognized that colleges are particularly the marketplace of ideas, and that if there's any place in our nation that speech should be free, it's on our college campuses. I disagree strongly that Hazelwood applies here. Hazelwood was a case about a high school newspaper. Here we're dealing with adults. And in a very different situation, I think the more appropriate precedent here, the more appropriate line of cases, is Papish versus Board of Curators of the University of Missouri, where the court was very clear that the mere dissemination of ideas, which this is, it doesn't matter how offensive it is, may not be shut off in the name alone of conventions of decency. And that's exactly what President Boren has done here.
Doug Letterman at Inside Higher Ed, for those of us who are civilians, who are not attorneys, there is the question, and Tracy alluded to it earlier, about perhaps an institutional responsibility. For others, it might be a case of moral authority. We've seen this pop up even before the Oklahoma incident and the video went viral in terms of some of the yik-yak issues that have emerged at a number of campuses this fall and other instances. Sort of help us understand a little bit more about the landscape in terms of institutional responsibility, the possibility of moral authority, and also how institutions have responded in somewhat parallel situations.
Sure. So I am very much not a lawyer, and I don't play one on TV, so I'm not going to try to speak to the sort of real legal lines of authority. I think there's no question that in a lot of these cases, and I think this is true in Oklahoma as well, the universities in making these decisions are following their campus policies, not the law. Oklahoma's policy has a clause that sort of opens the door, it seems, to allow this kind of action by the president. Now, it doesn't mean that the policies can't and probably will eventually be challenged in to see whether the policies are themselves legal. And certainly FIRE has, Mr. Shibley's organization has challenged lots of speech codes, and I'm pretty confident this could well end up being challenged as well. But there is a lot of institutions certainly have taken it to believe it is in their responsibility to put some boundaries around speech that is viewed as hurtful, as threatening, particularly as threatening, which is some of the language that was used here in the Oklahoma case. And again, whether this ultimately gets challenged in court is an open question, and how that would, I wouldn't be, pretend to predict how it might come out. But I think there's a lot. I think what President Boren's action drew a lot of praise from others in higher education. Obviously, a lot of pushback from pure First Amendment purists. But it's a, I think it's seen that there's increasing pressure on college leaders to try to create an environment in which people don't feel threatened. Now, the push is how much threat is really at issue in a case like this is an open question and one that's debated.
Tracy, let me come back to you because you seem to feel that there is an institutional authority to do so. Talk a little bit more about that, if you would, please.
Well, the case that many people have been talking about as persuasive in favor of free speech in this case is often the one that also has a fraternity involved in it, the Sigma Chi fraternity. This is a 1993 case that was in the Fourth Circuit. And, well, that decision found for the students and against the university. I would call attention to the concurring opinion that concurred because the fact pattern in this case was that this was a student activity and that the institution, through its student affairs office, had given permission for them to do this skit that involved, to some observers, racist stereotypes. The concurrence I find very interesting because all of the dicta of it gives a wonderful brief of how, where, when, and why in case law it has been found that in educational circumstances the First Amendment has more restriction that the institution can place on speech in the name of safety and alignment with its mission. But the judge only found for the students in this case because the school had not revoked the permission it had given the students to do the skit in the first place. And obviously,
Robert Shibley, let me turn to you on part of this. There's a lot of commentary from legal scholars and others suggesting that the university overreached in expelling the students. Did the university overreach? Was it within its authority to do so?
Oh, they absolutely did. President Boren, in fact, I think actually saying the university overreached is actually giving a little too much credit to this decision. If you read the letter from President Boren that is the expulsion letter that was released on March 10th, he says that as president, he has determined they should be expelled. He doesn't mention that there was any kind of hearing. They didn't get notice. They didn't get a hearing. They were just simply expelled based on the video. He says it is because specifically of what they said. It's because of your leadership role in leading a racist and exclusionary chant. Which, and then he appeals to the idea of hostile educational environment. And we hear a lot about that with this too. The fact is, though, that there is a definition for a hostile educational environment. That comes from yet another, non-lawyers, Supreme Court case, Davis versus Monroe County Board of Education from 1999, that talks about what harassment is in, what discriminatory harassment is in the peer-on-peer educational context. And that's sort of a long test. I'm happy to go into it if you'd like. But the fact is, it requires things to be severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive. And I don't think you can straight-facedly make the argument that this particular song, remember, David Boren is saying it's this song on the bus. I don't think you can make the argument that it meets the pervasiveness requirement, simply because A, it was on the bus. B, it wasn't even, as far as we know, on campus. And C, it would never have even gotten out if somebody hadn't taped it and themselves, you know, who are not SAE, but the people who taped it distributed the tape. I don't understand how you can make the argument that these people were engaging in the pervasiveness. That's not to talk down how offensive it is, how people might be reasonably offended by it. I completely understand that. I think everybody does. I don't think that the sentiments are defensible. But I think all of this, this talk of, well, let's use Hazel, what, a high school case from a high school newspaper. Let's use,
wait, Robert,
you know,
I
don't
have...
think that's going to work.
Robert, I'm going to ask both you and Tracy. You are both attorneys, and you're determined to help those of us as civilians get a thorough background. But I'm, you know, if you can keep us a little above some of the deep weeds, that would be very helpful. Tracy, let me come back to you. It seems inevitable that this decision is going to be challenged. There's lots of commentary that the two students have found attorneys, and the attorneys are likely to challenge the expulsion decision. If the students had not been expelled, what are some of the other options open to the university in terms of disciplinary actions that might be viable in this instance?
They could have been suspended, and then there could have been internal due process that would be entirely reasonable approach to have taken. But, you know, I'm grateful to learn about this case, Davis versus Monroe, and I think that it would be very interesting to test this situation against the test that Robert mentioned, severe, pervasive, and discriminatory environment, especially with what we've subsequently come to learn about this fraternity and their activities over a very long period of time.
Robert, you mentioned the absence of due process. You know, you know, we have to assume that President Boren, and no doubt conferred with university counsel and perhaps others about what his options were, but in fact, the record seems to suggest there was no due process in terms of a public hearing for the students, that some might argue the university clearly wanted to act quickly, and some would argue the university also acted arbitrarily. How big of an issue is the absence of due process in terms of how this might go forward in terms of legal action and legal appeal?
I think that's definitely going to be a part of the case. You know, as far as we know, so they seem to be in some sort of investigatory mode to try to determine who all was in the chant. It seems like what they've decided, and this shows the sort of political basis for it, is it sounded like a lot of people were singing on there. Who did they punish? The two people whose faces were on the video. And the arbitrariness and the fact that, I mean, how did they make that determination? Did David Boren himself look and say, yeah, it kind of looks like that? How is it that they did it? That's the reason we have due process, so we can be sure that these things are done in a non-arbitrary fashion. And I'm afraid President Boren, who's actually been pretty good on free speech in the past, has really, you know, bowed to political pressure here and just decided that regardless of the legal precedent, nobody seems to think he can win a case, regardless he needs to punish these folks for political reasons.
And Doug Letterman, the Oklahoma incident occurs in the larger context of a broader conversation about racism on campus and, also in terms of American society. In the wake of Oklahoma, in the wake of some of the other instances that we've seen on college campuses this fall dealing with racial issues, what happens next? What's your guess about the kinds of conversations campus leaders are having with their executive staff and with legal counsel in the wake of Oklahoma?
Well, we just published our annual survey of presidents that came out about a few days after the Oklahoma case, showing that about 80% of college presidents don't think think race relations on their campus are good or excellent. And it was a fair bit of irony in that coming in a few days after the Oklahoma video was released. I think there's a lot of tension on campus. There's a lot of pressure. This week's incident at UVA, which we're still learning about, where a student was appeared to have been sort of bloodied by cops by alcohol control people outside a bar, and it has raised, there's just enormous tension on a lot of campuses about the role of race, and presidents are under a lot of pressure that has clearly influenced President Bourne's decision here. I think, it isn't just about race. And I think there's increasing efforts to try to make campuses a sort of quote safe space. And I think that inevitably creates legal tension. And I don't think there's any place for this to go but to more conflict and more tension over between efforts to sort of keep speech civil, et cetera, and let speech flourish.
Great. Thanks to my thanks to the three of you, Tracy Matrano, a principal with Matrano and Associates, Robert Shibley, the executive director of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, and Doug Letterman from Inside Higher Ed, for a fast-moving conversation about the complexity of free speech on college campuses in the wake of the Oklahoma incident. Thank you all. In our second segment today, we will talk about bonus payments for better retention numbers. Campus presidents and provosts are under rising pressure to address the completion agenda and to improve student retention. But what if the numbers improve? Should faculty and staff benefit from, quote, a performance bonus, end quote, based on some share of the additional institutional revenue which typically follows rising retention rates? And if so, and in the absence of a chief retention officer at most institutions, there's the question of who decides who benefits from the pool. Who gets to participate in the bonus, and what should they be paid? This question has been asked and is now being answered with a novel initiative at Coastal Carolina University, a public comprehensive liberal arts institution of some 10,000 students in Conway, South Carolina. 2 years ago, the university launched a kind of profit-sharing program based on improved retention rates to address salary compression. And the program seems to be working. Retention rates at Coastal Carolina are up, projected to hit 74% in the next few years, compared to a mid-60% number before the Great Recession hit in 2008 and falling to 59% in 2009. Moreover, since launching the program 2 years ago, the university has paid some $2.5 million to faculty and staff who qualified under the guidelines for the retention bonus program developed by faculty members. With us to discuss this program at Coastal Carolina, we have Ralph Byington, Provost and Senior Vice President for Academic and Student Affairs at Coastal Carolina, and Thomas Hoffman, who's an Associate Professor and Chair of the Mathematics Department at Coastal Carolina, and joining us as well, Doug Letterman, who is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Ralph Byington, Provost, Senior Vice President at Coastal Carolina, help us understand a little bit of the background that led to this program. By all accounts, it seems to be unique.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was really a program that was a long-term commitment to faculty and staff from administration and from the Board of Trustees. But the interesting thing about this program is really the development, and that was from the Faculty Welfare and Development Committee, and in particular Tom Hoffman, and a couple other faculty members were instrumental. So it may be best if we let Tom address the development of the program.
So, Thomas Hoffman, you seem to get credit or a lot of credit from your provost in terms of playing a major role in this process. Talk with us about faculty involvement. Tell us a little about the algorithm that determines who benefits.
Well, so for a little bit of history, Faculty Welfare and Development Committee, going back into the early 2000s, had been measuring compression. And so actually the chair before me, Dr. Mike Roos, had built a model, measured compression, and actually had started getting the school to pay for it.
All right. So, Tom Hoffman, I'm going to ask you just very quickly, clarify compression for those who are not familiar with that term.
So, we built a model that where we kind of compare our faculty salaries to the average salaries by discipline across the country. And so we consider somebody compressed if their current salary is below where we think they should be. So we just We have a linear model, and we just compare their salary to that line. If they're below the line, we consider them compressed.
Okay.
And so we've been doing this for, I think, since about 2000 or 2001. And when I took over that committee, you know, we were doing this model annually. We would go to the then provost and say, you know, look, we're compressed by this much. And we would usually get the answer, well, that's good information to have, but how are we going to pay for it? So about 4 years ago, I started working with the faculty senate chair, Keshav Jagannathan, and we started working on this model, trying to figure out, okay, we want to get some money for compression. It'd be nice if we had some bonuses in there, but we need to bring a method of paying for it as well. Fortunately for us, we kind of took the approach of, well, let's work with the administration instead of an us versus them kind of dichotomy. And we worked very closely with the provost and the vice president for finance to kind of come up with a model that would be sustainable and would get the faculty some additional salary and then bonuses.
Ralph Byington, since there's, again, there's no coach, like a football coach with winning and losing seasons, what determines eligibility on the part of faculty and staff to participate?
Yeah, once the model is run and we come up with the compression numbers, then what happens is it's turned over to my office. And within that model, it talks about faculty being competitive. And then we've also added the meritorious side to faculty in measuring who gets how much and how much of a reward that they actually receive. So we go through that analysis where we look at a competitive faculty member, a faculty member that has, you know, was brought in, they're still an assistant professor prior to going up for tenure, so they consider to be competitive during that time period. Then once again, once they're promoted to associate or the full, or they've gone through a post-tenure review with a meritorious rating, then they're considered to be competitive. Every year, additionally, we get input from the department chairs that gives us the meritorious faculty. So we put those two together in the model and fund the compression amount based on that comparison.
All right. So, Doug Letterman, lots of campuses have been talking about retention for a long time. It seemed to be elevated beginning around 1980 with the demographic downturn. Lots of presidents talk about raising rates. Some campuses actually do it. How unique is the program at Coastal Carolina?
Well, it's definitely something we hadn't come across before in quite this form. I think that one of the things that's really, well, there's a bunch of things that are interesting and positive about it. It is nice to hear administrations and faculties talk about working together on solving a problem. There are a lot of campuses that are not paying their faculty, obviously, what the faculty think they should be paid. And we're in an era, particularly at public institutions, of diminished funds. And so it's really heartening to see sort of a creative approach to producing money, additional money that can be used for this purpose. There are obviously some questions about it and some concerns. I think there's the university certainly seems to be aware of them from our story about the possibility of too much encouragement to retain students and the possibility of grade inflation. I think it would be a mistake, and I don't think Coastal Carolina has done this, but it would be a mistake to assume that just giving bonuses or just rewarding faculty is a replacement for other kinds of support that students need. I think there's a lot of view that faculty interaction with students makes a difference, but there are obviously a lot of elements of retention.
Ralph Byington, lots of departments have differential retention rates. They have differential GPAs, often lower in the sciences, a mean lower GPA in the sciences than in some other areas. Does the algorithm that Tom Hoffman and his colleagues developed sort of take into consideration some of these departmental differentials?
Yeah, I think that's a very valid point. And I think when we're applying the model, we're looking for moving the entire university. So we are looking at that average retention rate. I do get individual analyses that give me the retention rates by departments. But just as you said, you know, I recognize that there's a difference between departments and what you expect. The motivation is that once we identify someone who's doing something extremely well and they have a high retention rate, we try to identify what might be causing that. And we do the same thing if we have one that's not performing at the same level, try to identify why they may not be at the retention rate. And you're right, it could be discipline specific, but it could be something else. There could be something that could be added. And that's what we've tried to do. we try to identify things we can do, and let me get out of the department just a second, because even with specific courses, there are courses that students historically have trouble with at a university. And so what we've tried to do is we've tried to take those courses and provide resources to allow students to be successful there. So that helps the science major as well as it helps, you know, the English major and the history major. It helps everyone.
You've talked about the faculty role in this. Are staff, student affairs professionals, and others also eligible to participate in this program?
Yeah, thanks for asking that, because this is a comprehensive model. So this is faculty and staff, and they both receive the same level of competitiveness adjustments and also for meritorious adjustments. Because we recognized, and when I became provost, we created a committee that was a joint committee that had student affairs and academic affairs, because they both report to me as my provost and vice president role. So we created this committee where the thought was educating the entire student, making sure that we realize how much they're in the classroom, but also all of the activities outside of the classroom. So everyone participates on this campus. The president created a program a few years ago, and it was Field of Teal from the student affairs side and from the administrative side there, but also then it was dealing with student success or academic success from the faculty side. So that total program is designed to allow us to give our students that positive experience.
So Tom Hoffman is one of the faculty members who designing the program, but I'm guessing probably had a role in also the algorithm, given that you're a mathematician. What's changed? I mean, how have you tinkered with the program after it's been launched?
Actually, so since it was launched 2 years ago, we haven't really tinkered with it. There was lots of tinkering before that in all of the discussions. But because we were working with the administration, I think we had a very good algorithm at the outset of this program. And so I think we can wait a couple of years and kind of see how it goes and then start tinkering with it again then. But for right now, changes really haven't been made.
And let me come back to Ralph Byington again. So 2 years into this program, I'm guessing that you've had lots of inquiries from other institutions saying, why did you do this? How did you do this? How can we do this? Ralph Byington, is that the case?
Well, actually, I figure after this conversation, we probably will get a lot more. We have had those conversations. I'm on my way right now to NASPA, which I'm on the program, and one of the things we're going to talk about is that blending of academic and student affairs. And in particular, I plan on talking about this topic of how you provide these resources for faculty and staff who are doing having a very positive impact on what we're about for retention and graduation also. So we have not had that many inquiries to date because, just once again, I think it hasn't gotten out as much as we would like for it to.
And Tom Hoffman, just as we close, what's your guess as your counterparts at other institutions, faculty members, hear about this both in terms of the money, the focus on retention, but also faculty involvement? Again, to pick up on Doug Letterman's point, this is a rare instance where there seems to be goodwill and good collaboration on a major policy change that involves money.
Yeah, I think a lot of faculty will like the, you know, additional pay. They might initially react poorly that it's tied to retention, but one of the things that some faculty don't understand is retention has a lot of causes, right? And so we can't just kind of pick one thing and try and fix that. And so the nice thing about this plan is it says, okay, we want the faculty to kind of buy into retention and start working on it across the board. And so, you know, Ralph could probably speak to this better than I can, but there are a lot of plans across campus to deal with retention. And a lot of them require faculty involvement. And so by kind of getting this tie-in, it says, okay, look, we really do appreciate you guys working on all of these different topics. It's not all just classroom oriented. We have a lot of plans and they're all trying to work on different aspects. And so I think once the faculty kind of see that, I'm hoping that they would like this sort of plan.
Great. Ralph Byington, Provost and Senior Vice President for Academic and Student Affairs at Coastal Carolina. Your colleague, Thomas Hoffman, Associate Professor and Chair of the Math Department at Coastal Carolina, thank you for joining us. Thanks as well to Doug Letterman. Two, we also want to thank Tracy Matrano at Matrano & Associates and Robert Shipley of the FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, for the discussion in the first segment about free speech and the First Amendment, what that means on campus. This Week in Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or podcast early afternoon on most Fridays. On the web, we're available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. This Week is also available on iTunes. Please share your thoughts about the This Week program with us on the comments section of our webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.